And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country, and one of the most corrupt. Well, I've never seen elected officials do so many backflips to protect crooks. And I want to give a shout out to Rich Forrest, who is still in the hospital. Need to get up and get around. Today is August 23rd, the 235th day of the year. 130 days remain until this year is over with. In 30 BC, after the successful invasion of Egypt, Octavian executes Marcus Antonius Antillius, eldest son of Mark Antony and Caesarion, the last king of the Ptolemaic dynasty of Egypt. Only child of Julius Caesar and Cleopatra. 20 BC, Ludi Vulcanalisi are held within the temple precinct of Vulcan and are used by Augustus to mark the treaty with Parthia and the return of the legionary standards that had been lost at the Battle of Carrhae in 53 BC. AD 79, Mount Vesuvius begins to stir on the feast day of Vulcan, the Roman god of fire. 476, Odoacer, chieftain of the Germanic tribes, is proclaimed Rex Italia, king of Italy, by his troops. And that's when they overran Rome. And the Roman legions couldn't or didn't stop them. 1244, siege of Jerusalem. The city citadel, the Tower of David, surrenders to Khwarezmian in the empire. When in doubt, quit. 1268, the Battle of Tagliacozzo marks the fall of the Hohenstaufen family from the imperial and Sicilian thrones and leading to the new chapter of Angevin domination of southern Italy. 1305, Sir William Wallace is executed for high treason at Smithfield, London. Now, he was a Scottish knight who became one of the main leaders during the First War of Scottish Independence. Along with Andrew Murray, Wallace defeated an English army at the Battle of Stirling Bridge in September 1297, appointed guardian of Scotland, and served till his defeat at the Battle of Falkirk in July of 1298. In August of 1305, he was captured in Robroston, near Glasgow, and handed over to King Edward I of England and had him hung, drawn, quartered for high treason and crimes against English civilians. Since his death, he's become an iconic, achieved an iconic status far beyond his homeland. Alrighty. 1328, Battle of Cassel. French troops stop an uprising of Flemish farmers. 1382, the Siege of Moscow. The Golden Horde, led by Toctamish, lay siege to the capital of the Grand Duchy of Moscow. The Golden Horde were the Mongols. The Golden Horde was self-designated as Ulug Ulus. In Turkic, that means great state. Originally a Mongol and later a Turkicized khanate established in the 13th century and originating in the northwestern sector of the Mongol Empire. When the Mongol Empire fell apart in 1259, but became a functionally separate khanate, also known as the Ulus of Josi. So, 1514, the Battle of Chaldrian ends with a decisive victory for the Sultan Selim I of the Ottoman Empire. He defeated Shah Ismail I, founder of the Safavid dynasty. 1521, Christian II of Denmark is deposed as King of Sweden and Gustav Vasa is elected regent. 1541, French explorer Jacques Cartier lands near Quebec City on his third voyage to Canada. 1572, French war of religion. Mob violence against thousands of Huguenots in Paris results in the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. 1595, long Turkish war. Wallachian prince Michael the Brave confronts the Ottoman army in the Battle of Calugarini and achieves a tactical victory. 1600, Battle of Gifu Castle. The eastern forces of Tokugawa Ieyasu defeat the western Japanese clans royal to Toyotomi Hideyori, leading to the destruction of Gifu Castle and serving as a prelude to the Battle of Sekigahara. 1628, George Villiers, the first Duke of Buckingham, was assassinated by John Felton. 1655, Battle of Sabota. The Swedish Empire, led by Charles X Gustav, defeats the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. 1703, during the event, Sultan Mustafa II of the Ottoman Empire is dethroned. The 1741 eruption of Oshima, the Kampo tsunami. At least 2,000 people along the Japanese coast drowned in a tsunami caused by the eruption of Oshima. 1775, American Revolutionary War. King George III delivers his proclamation of rebellion to the court of St. James, stating that the American colonies had proceeded to a state of open and avowed rebellion. 1784, Western North Carolina, which is considered, which is now Eastern Tennessee, declares itself an independent state under the name of Franklin. Now, it's not accepted into the United States and only lasts for 4 years. 1799, Napoleon I of France leaves Egypt for France en route to seizing power. 1813, at the Battle of Obrien, the Prussians under von Bülow repulse the French army. 1831, Nat Turner's slave rebellion is suppressed. 1839, United Kingdom captures Hong Kong as a base as it prepares for the first Opium Wars with King China. 1864, American Civil War. Union Navy captures Fort Morgan, Alabama, which breaks Confederate dominance of all ports on the Gulf of Mexico except for Galveston, Texas. 1866, the Austro-Prussian War ends with the Treaty of Prague. 1873, the Albert Bridge in Chelsea in London opens up. 1898, the Southern Cross Expedition. The first British venture of the heroic age of Antarctic exploration departs from London on this date. 1904, the automobile tire chain is patented. 1914, World War I. British Expeditionary Force and the French Fifth Army begin their great retreat before the German Army. 1914, World War I. Japan declares war on Germany. 1921, British airship R-38 experiences structural failure over hull in England and crashes in the Humber estuary. Over 49 British and American training crew, only 4 survive. 1923, Captain Lowell Smith and Lieutenant John Richter perform the first mid-air refueling on a de Havilland DH-4B, setting an endurance flight of record of 37 hours. 1927, Italian anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti are executed after a lengthy controversial trial. 1929, the Hebron Massacre during the 1929 Palestinian riots takes place. Arab attack on a Jewish community in Hebron and the British Mandate of Palestine continues until the next day, results in the death of 65 to 68 Jews and the remaining Jews being forced to leave the city. 1939, World War II. Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union signed a non-aggression treaty, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. In a secret addition to the pact, the Baltic states, Finland, Romania, and Poland are divided between the two nations. 1942, World War II, beginning of the Battle of Stalingrad. 1943, World War II, Kharkiv is liberated by the Soviet Union after the Battle of Kursk. 1944, World War II, Marseille is liberated by the Allies. Also in 1944, World War II, King Michael of Romania dismisses the pro-Nazi government of Marshal Antonescu, who is arrested. Romania switches sides from the Axis to the Allies. 1944, the Freckleton Air Disaster. The U.S. Army Air Force B-24 Liberator bomber crashes into a school in Freckleton, England. Kills 61 people. Now, this was United States Army Air Force B-24 because the U.S. Air Force didn't really exist as a separate unit until 1947. 1945, World War II, Soviet-Japanese War. USSR State Defense Committee issues decree number 9898CC about receiving accommodation and labor utilization of the Japanese Army prisoners of war. 1946, ordinance number 46 that a British military government constitutes the German Länder, or states of Hanover and Schleswig-Holstein. 1948, World Council of Churches is formed by 147 churches from 44 countries. 1954, the first flight of the Lockheed C-130 multi-role aircraft. 1958, Chinese Civil War. The second Taiwan Strait crisis begins with the People's Liberation Army bombardment of Quemoy. 1966, Lunar Orbiter 1 takes the first photograph of Earth from orbit around the moon. 1970, organized by Mexican-American labor union leader Cesar Chavez, the Salad Bowl Strike, the largest farm worker strike in U.S. history, begins. 1973, a bank robbery gone wrong in Stockholm, Sweden, turns into a hostage crisis. Over the next 5 days, the hostages began to sympathize with their captors, which led to the creation of the term the Stockholm Syndrome, where the captives sympathized and began to help the captors. 1975, the start of the Wave Hill walk-off by Gurindji people in Australia, which lasted 8 years. It was a landmark event in the history of indigenous land rights in Australia, commemorated in a 1991 Paul Kelly song and an annual celebration. 1975, the Pontiac Silver Dome opens in Pontiac, Michigan, 30 miles northwest of Detroit. 1985, Hans Treitsch, top counter-spy of West Germany, defects to East Germany. 1989, Singing Revolution. 2 million people from Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania start on the Vilnius Tallinn Road, holding hands. This is called the Baltic Way or the Baltic Chain. 1990, Saddam Hussein appears on Iraqi state TV with a number of Western guests to try to prevent the Gulf War. These Western guests were actually hostages who were told to look good. Okay, everybody and their dog has something to say, sell these days, and they make cold calls. 1990, Armenia declared its independence from the Soviet Union on this date. Also in 1990, West and East Germany announced their reunite October 3rd. 1991, the World Wide Web, which had been created for military use, is open to the public. 1994, Eugene Bullard, the only African-American pilot in World War I, is posthumously commissioned as second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force. 2000, Gulf Air Flight 072 crashes into the Persian Gulf near Manama in Bahrain, kills 140. Okay, I had to stop there. Every other Thursday, the Department of Veterans Affairs has a telephone town hall where they talk about all kinds of information for veterans, and I'm 100% disabled veteran, so I make it a point to listen. And now we're going to get back to our finishing up our history segment. The 2006, Natasha Kampusch, who had been abducted at age 10, escapes from her captor, Wolfgang Ficklopil, after 8 years of captivity. 2007, the skeletal remains of Russia's last royal family member, Alexei Nikolaevich Tsarevich of Russia and his sister, Grand Duchess Anastasia, are allegedly discovered near Yekaterinburg in Russia. Now, there's a number of folks who say they're have said they're Grand Duchess Anastasia. But, of course, Russia has a vested interest in making sure that that little particular part of history goes away, so we don't know for sure if, in fact, they were the actual remains. 2011, a magnitude 5.8, which is considered moderate earthquake, occurs in Virginia. Damage occurs to monuments and structures in Washington, D.C., and the damage is estimated to be $200 to $300 million in 2011 dollars. 2011, Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi is overthrown after the National Transitional Council forces take control of Bab al-Azizi compound during the Libyan Civil War. 2012, a hot air balloon crashes near Slovenian capital of Ljubljana, killing 6 people and injuring 28 others. And in 2013, a riot at the Palmasola prison complex in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, kills 31. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Quite a number. Too far, too many to go into. Holidays observances, Battle of Kursk Day in Russia, Christian Feast Day, Asselina, Asterius Claudius and Neon, Ilgon of Ardstraw, Lupus of Novaea, Philip Benitius, Coriolatius and Companions of Ostia, Rose of Lima, Tide Phil, Zacharias of Jerusalem, Day of the National Flag in Ukraine, European Day of Remembrance for Victims of Stalinism and Nazism, or also known as Black Ribbon Day. That's celebrated in the European Union and other countries. Liberation of Fascist Occupation Day. Well, let me say this. The scammers are out in full force today. That call told me that I had a federal agent waiting to talk to me about a criminal activity. I needed to stop what I was doing and push one. Now, two scam calls back to back. It's an interesting day. Well, in Romania, we have Liberation from Fascist Occupation Day, International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition. In Iran, National Day for Physicians. That's interesting coming from Iran. And Umlanga Day in Swaziland. Okay, let's see what else we got. In 79 A.D., Mount Vesuvius begins erupting on the feast day of Vulcan, the god of fire. It went on to destroy Pompeii. 406 A.D., the battle at Florence. Stilicho's Roman army beats Radagasius' barbarians. 1046, King Henry III gives money to the Utrecht Deventer Diocese. 1059, Treaty of Melfi. Pope Nicholas II recognized the Norman conquest of southern Italy by appointing Norman adventurer Robert Guiscard, Duke of Apulia and Calabria and Count of Sicily. God has spoken. Let's see. 1441, Holland and Hanzestaden sign a ceasefire treaty. 1500, Governor Francisco de Bordila arrives in the Indies. Shortly after that, he arrests and sends former Governor Christopher Columbus back to Spain in chains. In 1553, Bishop Stephen Gardiner appointed English Lord Chancellor. In 1617 in London, the first one-way street was established. As an individual I know about said when he was given a ticket for going the wrong way on a one-way street, he said, "I was just going one way." 1708, Madinganu Pamhiba is crowned king of Manipur. 1711, Admiral Hovenden Walker's fleet reaches St. Lawrence. 1789, French Revolution. The National Assembly proclaims freedom of religious opinions, which is quite an interesting turnabout on their part. 1793, French Revolution. The National Convention adopts the levy en masse, conscripting all able-bodied men between 18 and 25 for military service during the French Revolutionary Wars. 1796, the African Methodist Episcopal Church is incorporated. 1838, Mount Holyoke Female Seminary in South Hadley, Massachusetts has its first graduating class. 1839, the British capture Hong Kong from China on this date. 1862, the skirmish at Big Hill, Kentucky, involving two federal regiments. 1864, Union troops and fleet occupy Fort Morgan, Alabama. 1869, the first carload of rail freight, which consisted of boots and shoes, arrives in San Francisco from Boston. It only took 16 days to get there. 1872, the first Japanese commercial ship visited San Francisco, carrying tea. 1879, Governor General Charles Gordon of Sudan returns to Cairo. He was eventually killed by the Mahdi's troops. Okay, this is my day for interesting calls. And finally, in 1921, Britain declared a truce with the Irish nationalist Sinn Féin. And in 1921, Austria and the U.S. formally end the war. And the U.S. does the same with Germany on the 25th and Hungary on the 29th. That being said, we're going to turn to talking more about Area 51. That is a fascinating place. I've been to the black mailbox. I tried to get through the security checkpoint, and while my ID card got me through the first one, it didn't the second one. And now, according to the mysterious John, who was interviewed by a number of people about what went on there, because he worked there. Now, on his first arrival at Area 51, he used to be NYPD. Remember, I talked about him in my last show. Well, he first got there, he was taken to one particular office known as the History Department. At least that's what the guys that worked there called it. And he got a briefing from a trio of men in black who all gave him NASA ID cards to prove their identity. Now, they weren't the men in black of the that supposedly shows up at UFO sightings. And he was formally introduced to his fellow workers. And his job, he was told, was to ensure that certain highly classified files were looked after and kept under lock and key, except when they were needed by the workers to do their job. There were two of the men and one woman that worked in the same area and all had basically the same job as he did. And some, you know, to put it in layman's terms, he was an archivist. Now, the documentation that he and his colleagues had to oversee dealt with what amounted to four different issues. The history of advanced weapon systems, chemical and biological warfare, secret aircraft tests flown at the base, and what was known euphemistically as something else. Now, that's something else he learned. Was directly linked to extraterrestrial life and UFOs. In other words, he was about to be exposed to what you might call Area 51's greatest and biggest secret of all. Now, before he got the briefing of a lifetime, he was given the lowdown on the process of how that documentation he was to look after could be handled. If base employees needed to review any of the historical documents, that review had to be done in that room with John there at all times overseeing the handling of the files. Now, it was okay for employees to take notes from the files, provided they were made in what was always a bright orange paper, using a pencil, and only a pencil. He couldn't use an ink pen. Now, John wondered if perhaps that paper could have been detected if anybody tried to smuggle anything out of the base. Now, of all the four areas of historical files the group had access to, those that fell under the something else category were the most interesting, for lack of a better term. John said the vast amounts of documentation ran from 1943 to 1968 were focused on the history of the U.S. government's knowledge of and interaction with alien entities who weren't just visiting us, but living on Earth among us. Now, he had heard about the Air Force Project Blue Book, which was a low-level operation established by the Air Force to investigate UFO sightings, but this was something far beyond that. He read with his jaw hanging open numerous documents that revealed that the remains of a number of crashed UFOs were stored at the base, as well as a handful of bodies of dead aliens, some of which were in very good condition, a couple in poor states, and as if they'd had violent accidents, and John learned that actually was the case. They had had rather violent crashes. Now, he was careful to explain to those he talked to that the endless amount of material he saw, he never personally saw a UFO or an alien, dead or alive. And he never saw a space vehicle from another world. All his knowledge came from written records. Now, he saw in 1947, according to the files, the government created a secret group to oversee the growing perceived threat posed by what might be seen as the extraterrestrial menace. He never knew the name of the group since it was blacked out in the pages of the documents he had access to. And at some point in 1960, the group created a splinter organization to work closely with a secret arm of NASA to try and understand the nature of the alien technology and hopefully duplicate it, reverse engineer it perhaps. By all accounts, not a great deal of advancement had been made, and it apparently was also the case by 1970. The technology, according to the records, was so beyond most people's comprehension that the scientists on the program can do little other than scratch their heads. Then in late 1960s, a radical decision was made. Coupled to them, the files John read made it clear that various top-secret UFO programs existed and were situated all across the country. Some of that work was done at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Other research was done at the Utah-based Dugway Proving Ground, which is just about as secret as Area 51. Alien bodies were stored at various facilities around the U.S., so a decision was made to consolidate all this material into one location. A highly secure, well-guarded facility. And that, of course, is Area 51, which was overseen by a group within the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, according to what he learned, up until the end of the 60s, Area 51 was only involved in classified issues relative to such projects as the U-2 spy plane, SR-71 Blackbird, and various other spy planes of a prototype nature. You know, when I was in Rachel, Nevada, when I took a busload of folks from Anaheim, California, the people that lived there told me that long before it became public, they were watching the Blackbird, the U-2, and a number of stealth planes fly over Rachel. Now, there was a lot of work also done in the fields of chemical warfare, biological warfare, surveillance technologies, and other type of advanced weapon systems. That all changed, though, when Area 51 became the consolidation point for all things alien. It wasn't just extraterrestrial technology and the bodies that were secretly transported to Area 51. It was all the people who'd worked on these earlier separate projects around the country. They were all moved to Area 51. Everyone who'd ever worked on the program could now do their work from Area 51 and from nowhere else. And this is one of the primary reasons why John was offered a unique opportunity. It was essential that all the massive amounts of alien-oriented documentation transferred to Area 51 be looked at and stored under the absolute strictest regimes possible. Now, Area 51 was now something close to the real-life Aladdin's Cave, as I've heard a number of people say, but the treasures it held were created in galaxies far, far away, maybe even in the heart of a faraway galaxy, and John was going to be one of the key figures who looked after all this material, material that over 99% of the world's population had absolutely no knowledge about. Now, of course, being put in that position was both unusual, incredible, and a little intimidating. But it was the offer of a lifetime. An offer that very few of us would ever turn down. Now, one of the most sinister aspects of the whole story came to John within just a few days of working at Area 51. And he was told by fellow personnel at that facility that many of those who were allied to the original program, and when the highly classified files were held at places like Wright-Patterson and Dugway's Proving Ground had gone rogue. That is to say, more than a few senior personnel in UFO programs had taken highly controversial steps to try to reveal the truth of what was going on and the alien evidence held by the U.S. government to the public. And this, of course, resulted in the government taking just about the most extreme actions possible to ensure that certain folks didn't talk. Again. Ever.
We're talking about the termination of people who have received as potential untrustworthy whistleblowers. He was told that the deaths on the program authorized by the program involved car accidents, suicide, heart attacks, and more. All made to look innocent, of course. In reality, they were carefully orchestrated murders. Other people in the programs just simply vanished and were never seen again. Of course, John, as a retired police officer, was disturbed by what he was seeing and hearing. He began to wonder what he got himself into. On top of that, certain top secret files vanished as well. Documents that had included some of the original raw intelligence material in the Roswell affair of 1947. Masses of paper were also destroyed, chiefly to hide the controversial acts had been committed to silence certain people. In other words, the U.S. government authorized the murder of certain, let's call them ufologists, for lack of a better term. Now, as for the specific files that John oversaw, he recalled the earliest UFO-themed document he had had the opportunity to read came from 1944. And that's 3 years before the alleged Roswell incident that took place in the summer of 1947. The document was prepared by a medical operative in the employ of the New Mexico-based Los Alamos Laboratory, where a lot of the top-secret work on the atomic bomb program was being done. And that led to the atomic destruction of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the summer of 45. Now, the letter in question that he had a chance to read was sent to a senior officer in the Office of Strategic Service, or the famed OSS. That was the forerunner of what would have become the Central Intelligence Agency. According to that letter, it was in the final stages of the Second World War that a team from Los Alamos was ordered by the OSS to undertake extensive tests on a group of people who were brought into the facility under careful secret circumstances. And the letter writer was concerned on two fronts. First, the people were substantially different than the average human, and second, the man had significant suspicions he and his team had been lied to regarding where the people came from. According to the story outlined in the letter from 43, 17 people were taken to Los Alamos, reportedly came from hospitals and asylums in the U.S. to be used in controversial experimentation. The staff members in Los Alamos weren't fooled, and they were sure the story that was told to them was just total nonsense. The main reason was because of the physical appearance of this group of unusual individuals. They were all short in size, none of them, male or female, was over 5 feet in height. They were all completely hairless and had huge, staring eyes. Not the eyes of people with thyroid conditions, which causes eyes to bulge, but eyes that look normal except for their size. Similarly, the heads of the people were oversized as well, and all were brought into Los Alamos naked, which none of the staff could understand. For 3 or 4 months, the team was directed to learn all they could about the odd-looking band of people. Tests were undertaken on them, trying to figure out what had caused them, almost a dozen and a half people, to display nearly identical symptoms of a condition nobody could really understand. Yeah, they all had superficial similarities to those affected by a very rare condition called progeria, which is loss of hair. It also causes rapid aging, usually leading to those with the condition die in their teens, but that was where the similarities seemed to end. This was not progeria, as much as the team had tried to convince themselves that that was what was wrong with them, but of course the fact remained, the progeria being such a rare condition, how on earth had the OSS managed to get their hands on so many people, and why would they particularly care? Now, other issues disturbed the Los Alamos personnel as well. The group walked in odd ways, their legs moved in a robotic, jerky fashion. They never spoke, only making odd bark-like noises that scared the crap out of the staff, even though they were trained to deal with just about any and all medical conditions that might come to their attention. And the people were generally quiet, sitting together in a large room they'd been prepared for them. And when the time came for them to be separated, when various experiments were undertaken, they became aggressive and made high-pitched wailing noises that were ear-splitting. The only way to keep them quiet was to sedate them, which seems to be the answer to dealing with anybody in the medical facility that's unruly. As for what the people lived on, everything had to be mashed and condensed, and that included a number of types of fruit, oatmeal, and occasionally meat. As for liquid, it was water and every once in a while milk. Of course, milk caused some of them to vomit. Los Alamos staff became more and more suspicious as time went by, and they started doing a little bit of investigative work on their own. Several of the security personnel, whose job was to restrain the people when they turned violent, said the tale about the group coming from hospitals and asylums was actually not true. The guard said in reality no one had any idea where these people came from or what they really were. All the guards knew was they were found by a terrified rancher in one of the wilder parts of Arizona, wandering around in a confused and anxious state. Now, I think if I was dropped in northwest, or one of the wilder parts of Arizona, naked, unable to communicate with anybody, I'd be confused and anxious as well. And although the people soon ate well and were for the most part looked after, they were all dead by the end of 43, and nobody knew why they died. Autopsies revealed nothing about the nature of their death, although the autopsies did demonstrate their internal organs were not like ours. They had organs that clearly mirrored the heart and the stomach, but they were wildly different. Then shortly after the new year of 44 began, a team of personnel from the government descended on Los Alamos and collected the remains of those 17 entities, the bodies of whom had been carefully preserved. All the relevant paperwork was taken as well, and all this was with stern warnings never to talk about what they'd seen. Nevertheless, according to what John later learned, the senior doctor put all the relevant facts into a journal, unknowingly to anybody at Los Alamos or within the OSS, until it was revealed in a regular security check at Los Alamos facility. Well, the doctor vanished, shipped out to where no one knew where he went. As for the journal, it was confiscated, was never seen or heard from again. And that was a chilling way for John to be exposed to the massive stash of material he oversaw, and even more intriguing was to follow. One of the files that John distinctly remembers the name of is entitled Autopsies, Bodies Unknown, Origin 47. Those words have been written on a piece of paper and stapled to the more formal document below it. It was a report on the autopsies of 8 humanoids found in the New Mexico desert, but which oddly made no mention of an alien spacecraft or a craft of any kind, having also been found close to the border with Arizona. It was quite literally a case of the bodies being found by a local man who the fear of God put into him after he reported his find to the nearest military base. Physically, they looked very much like the strange people taken to Los Alamos back in 43, and notably, these new arrivals were also secretly shipped to Los Alamos. 4 of the bodies were found intact, whereas the remains of the other 4 were extremely damaged. But under what specific circumstances was something that was never resolved. John saw for the first time photos of these creatures. There were photos that showed human-like creatures, but which were clearly not Homo sapiens in nature. They did have 2 eyes, a nose, a mouth, and low-set ears. The heads were hairless, as was their entire body, and the bodies were muscular. And their skin color was a whitish-gray. John also saw a very similarly titled document called Autopsies, Bodies Unknown, Origin 47, Biological Problems and Deaths. Once again, that title was handwritten on a piece of paper and stapled to the report, suggesting that a newer title had been added to what was clearly a much older original document. John found this particular part of the story rather bizarre in nature. It dealt with an entire team of medical personnel in Los Alamos who had examined several strange dead bodies. The team died alarmingly quickly from what had been suspected as being some form of alien virus. It was a virus to which the creatures were completely impervious, but which proved fatal to any and all the people who were exposed to it. This was made all the more worrying because all the team was dressed in what today we'd call hazmat suits, which suggests the virus could have been incredibly invasive, perhaps even unstoppable if it could penetrate a hazmat suit. What may have been a hasty state of fear and emergency, all the bodies, aliens and humans, were burned. The ashes packed in sealed metal canisters. The strangest file of all he saw was entitled Suit Study 48 Armageddon. Now, this was a very complex document that was directed toward addressing the nature of the clothing found in at least some of the strange aviators who had lost their lives and who came from unknown origins. The location, Nebraska, which is also where the study secretly went ahead. The files, this having been later reached Area 51. In these particular cases, the outfits worn by these large-headed humanoid creatures were of a bright yellow color and somewhat resembled the outfits worn by military pilots. The biggest problem of all was removing the clothing. You know, no zippers, no buttons. It took the team tasked with examining the clothes hours to remove them, but when they understood the process, it all became relatively simple. Turns out the suits were held together by something vaguely resembling today's Velcro, but it had one amazing difference. it was as if the fibers were alive and bonded according to the particular wearer. It seemed to be an intelligent, self-aware outfit. And that's exactly what the files John read suggested. On one occasion, one of the team members volunteered to try on one of the suits. He was a six-footer. Just about managed to squeeze himself in. It was something he very quickly came to regret. When he climbed into that one-piece uniform, the fibers recognized the man was taller than the average alien and suit altered its size. Things got even more bizarre and terrifying. Within seconds, the man revealed later his mind was filled with the imagery of a worldwide destruction of countless cities and ruins, billions dead, and the earth in an Armageddon-like state. Now, this, of course, caused the man to panic to the degree he started to hyperventilate. His colleagues and friends quickly tore the suit off of him. After he recovered, the man was extensively debriefed by an out-of-state team of intelligence personnel. He told them he felt, or at least he believed, the outfit somehow retained the memories and thoughts of its previous wearer. The result was that when the man put the suit on, he picked up the apocalyptic images that flooded his mind. This led one and all to suspect the aliens were deceptive, dangerous entities that wanted us, the human race, gone. So the images of what looked like a worldwide nuclear war was designed to wipe us out. Personnel from both NASA and the CIA expressed an interest in the suits, but John couldn't remember any specifics as to what the outcome of that particular approach might have been. Notably, though, the one thing that really stayed in John's mind was the revelation the suits were deemed to be somehow alive. As a result, they were locked away with a clearance limited to only a very small group of people who knew how to handle them and who knew the potential dangers and hazards that these suits represented. There was also a large number of files that were focused on events in the summer of 47 in New Mexico, revolved around crashed UFOs, remains of dead aliens, and much more, even though John could never recall seeing the term Roswell used. Notably, he said a couple of files addressed the theory that all this could have been a result of a series of ingenious hoaxes engineered by the Soviets. That was everybody's booger bear in those years, which is extremely similar to the data provided to author Annie Jacobson by a source named Alfred O'Donnell when she was writing her book, Area 51, an uncensored history of America's top secret military base. The problem is, when you get in this realm of government disinformation, you don't know who to believe or what to believe. Now, John continued to work at Area 51 for a pre-planned period of 1 year, after which he was moved into the world of private security. Started doing background checks on people who had been seen as useful for the works of highly classified programs at Area 51 and within NASA. And he continued to work at this job until 1981 when he retired. Rather interesting to note, despite being exposed to an astonishing wealth of material at Area 51, he slowly began to wonder if his whole time spent there was nothing but a hoax of some sort. He speculated on the possibility this was all some sort of intricate mind game to flood his mind with bizarre tales and documents relative to dead extraterrestrials. Maybe he thought it was a royalty test to see if he'd run to the Washington Post or the New York Times. Well, he didn't do either. He stayed quiet until he was well into his old age, and as a result of his silence, offered prestigious positions for another decade. He also speculated on another possibility. Possibility that it did involve the Soviets. Although he was somewhat reluctant to address the matter in depth, which is somewhat intriguing, I think. He said he heard a few snippets of data suggesting a small program was trying to convince the Russians the U.S. government had not just dead alien bodies, but extraterrestrial technology, even highly advanced, powerful alien weaponry. He began to wonder if this was all a game designed to scare the Russians into thinking we had something we never really did, but which the staff members at Area 51 were hoping the Russians would come to believe. Well, John eventually died in 2013, as what is stated in his final years, he came to believe more and more that what he saw and read out of Area 51 was actually a huge mind game. Fabrication to have the Russians running around like chickens with their heads cut off, wasting their time on lies dressed up as incredible truths. Certainly during the Cold War era, anything was possible. Now, tales of what have infamously been called the mysterious black helicopters abound in the field of conspiracies. Two of the biggest questions surrounding the phenomena: who has the technology and power to fly such a craft, and where did they come from? One has good reasons to believe the phenomena had its origins at none other than Area 51. should be noted that accounts of black silent helicopters abound. Not only that, the origins can be traced back to a program that began in the early 70s in Area 51. In 1995, Aviation Week and Space Technology published an article that read, in part, the U.S. military has been working for years on at least two helicopter projects. The more recent is the development of a light, very quiet helicopter with a mass-mounted sight. The program's existence was underscored on April 9, 1991, during an interview with a former Lockheed official. When asked if he had heard of something called a quiet helicopter, he said, absolutely, a very quiet helicopter, but I can't talk about it. That's getting into sensitive areas. Now, that sensitivity was almost certainly driven by the fact the program had its origins at Area 51. One of those who had uncovered certain classified data on this particular project was a conspiracy theorist by the name of Jim Keith. I've read a number of his works. As we see, Keith died in 1999 under controversial, mysterious circumstances. Could he have been another victim of the government project to silence those who would talk about things like this? The issue of the silent helicopters is one that particularly intrigued Keith. After all, helicopters are known for their deep thump-thump sound, which we love to hear out in the jungle. So as to encounter a helicopter that's nearly silent or maybe even completely silent would be very amazing. In pursuing the tales of the silent copters, Keith found himself repeatedly pointed in the direction of Nevada and Area 51. In February 1995, the Las Vegas Review-Journal newspaper ran an article entitled "Ex-Worker Describes Stealth Helicopter," written by a journalist named Susan Green. After seeing that, Keith said, according to a statement by a former worker at Groom Lake Air Force Base, black budget stealth helicopters being tested at this facility as early as 1990. Code name for the helicopter was TEK, which stood for Test and Evaluation Project K. He went on to say the former worker at Groom Lake reported the copter was olive drab, riveted, and had angular gull-wing doors. An account to the Vegas newspaper quoted experts as saying light, quiet, and stealthy helicopters can be used for clandestine Rambo-type missions, quick-in, quick-out assignments without being noticed. Now, as I was leaving the military in the 80s to go in reserve status, I did see a number of helicopters that didn't have the normal thump, thump, thump that we were used to hearing. Of course, the mysterious helicopters were seen long before the 90s, something that suggests the program operating out of Groom Lake had been going on for decades. In other words, the secrecy surrounding the project suggests these futuristic aircraft had taken to the skies years before the secrecy was compromised in the 90s. Keep in mind, as I've said several times, whenever the government reveals some technology, it is two generations out of date. There's always something new on the drawing board. Unfortunately, Keith didn't have a chance to pursue this story. He died. Now, he may have stumbled on the tip of the iceberg when it came to the issue of silent mysterious helicopters. And it's highly possible these craft were flying as early as the 1960s. And one of them might have been test flown in England. According to a batch of files, the UK's National Archives declassified a number of years ago, Dame Rebecca West, MBE, was inadvertently plunged into a very strange puzzle in 1966. Incredibly, she said, some sort of unusual aerial object landed on the grounds of her home, which was known as Ibstone House. For its part, the file suggests the Ministry of Defense suggested West simply misidentified a helicopter seen in the poor conditions. Now, that might have been the case. Whatever the truth, her odd experience became the subject of a 15-page file that attracted the attention of the Ministry of Defense Intelligence staff. Born in 1892, Rebecca West, that was the adopted name of Cicely Isabel Fairfield, was the daughter of Charles Fairfield, who was renowned in London society. West took on the name Rebecca at the age of 19 after Ibsen's heroine in Rosmer's Home. Trained briefly for the stage in London before becoming a feminist and a journalist. And as her career took off, she wrote for the Free Woman, the Clarion, and the New Free Woman, and many of her writings from that time were reprinted as The Young Rebecca in 1982. In her first novel, The Return of the Soldier, which came out in 1918, as followed by The Judge, The Strange Necessity, and Harriet Hume. 1930, she married Henry Maxwell Andrews, a banker who was to accompany her on the journey that led to the publication of her two-volume study of the Yugoslav nation. She was president of the Nuremberg Trials. Her 1949 book, The Meaning of Treason, grew out of articles commissioned by the New Yorker. 1965, only 1 year before her curious UFO encounter occurred, her meaning of treason was updated with added accounts of what were then more recent scandals, including those of John Vassell, a spy in the Admiralty, sentenced to 18 years imprisonment, and Stephen Ward, a player in the Profumo case. So how did Dame Rebecca West become embroiled in such a controversy? As the old documentation at the UK's National Archives revealed, she was out walking on the grounds of her home. She was going down a steep hill to the farm building. She noticed a man walking on her property at some distance. Presently, he reached the point where the woods stopped, and there's a hedge that runs down the valley along a sharp ridge. There was a gap in the hedge, and he stopped just past this and turned around, facing in the direction from which he had come, and stood still. Expressing concern about what he was going to do, West watched in amazement as what she described as an aerial construction appeared out of nowhere. 1 minute it wasn't there, and next minute it was. It seemed to come down quite rapidly on the other side of the hedge from the man, but close to it. Her description of what that object was unusual, to say the least. Stressing to the Ministry of Defense, the object was strangely shaped. She said it consisted of something like a metal band, gray-blue in color, flattened at one end so as to be almost leaf-like, crossed with a sort of herringbone system of metal strips, and it was also somehow attached to these rather odd object, like a bag with an open end that had points made of the ocean material. And as she watched, that whole thing collapsed on the ground. She said it crumpled, but that wasn't quite the word. The metal band seemed to cut backward and disappear, while the curious bag looked as if somebody was squeezing the air out of the lower portion of it so that all the points stood up and fell back. Compared to the height of the object with the height of the man, she thought it was about 15 to 20 feet. Well, also wondering around her mind was the identity of that mysterious man. Stressing his behavior was odd, she continued that he seemed to be watching the thing come down. And the minute it came down, he turned around and followed the hedge back toward the valley. Once or twice, he looked to his left as if he was scrutinizing the valley, and he didn't seem to see Rebecca West. At the bottom of the track, he stopped again, looked all around the slope on which she was standing, and this time he saw her. Well, she said they stood and looked at each other for quite some time, and she had an uncomfortable feeling and turned and went home. The key question centered on the identity of the object. In her letter to the MOD, she wrote that a farm laborer informed her he had seen a helicopter flying in the vicinity early that day. She ventured the possibility it was some gadget sent out by the meteorological office. She's said in her letter she felt almost apologetic for burdening you with such an improbable story, but I didn't like to report it to the police, as I think you'll agree. An elderly woman who went to the local police with the story of having seen the equivalent of a flying saucer would add considerably to the difficulties of her life. Well, when her letter arrived at the MOD, that and her drawing was forwarded to a particular office known to have been involved in a collation of UFO data in the 60s. It's referred to as S4F Air. As the records show, one L.W. Ackhurst of that office then dispatched all the relevant data to a flight Lieutenant Mercer of the Defense Intelligence Staff. For his part, Mercer was inclined to accept that Dame Rebecca West saw a helicopter, possibly the Bell 47 or some similar top, which in condition of poor visibility appeared to have some unusual characteristics. Now, I would point out, just like our Air Force tends to explain away everything as a misidentified common item, the British are no different. They're not going to admit there's something in their airspace they can't control or identify. Now, West was far convinced by the MOD's explanation and sent a letter back to Ackhurst. "To have appeared where I saw it, a helicopter that had to fly 20 or 30 yards with its lower half deeply embedded in the earth." And there was at this entire time a complete silence, she said. And that visibility seemed to her not poor at all, for she spotted several birds at a considerable distance. She also said she didn't expect an answer to the letter. She concluded by saying, "I reported the incident partly because I feared the object might be a parachute or some such construction which was being used to drop something or somebody for a criminal purpose, and partly because the construction she saw or thought she saw puzzled her." Well, according to the records at the British Ministry of Defense, when Ackhurst got her follow-up letter, he sent everything to Flight Lieutenant Mercer of Defense Intelligence Staff. Mercer was inclined to accept that Rebecca West saw a helicopter, a Bell 47 or some similar type. Now, West was far from convinced by the explanation, as I said. Now, Ackhurst's response was basically blew it off, as officials are wont to do, so they don't have to do any work. For its part, the Ministry of Defense was satisfied with the explanation that the object was a helicopter. And its staff, in its defense, did make a good case for the craft being a helicopter. But West's letter clearly demonstrates she dismissed that notion that it was just a simple helicopter. She said, "I've seen many in my time, and I can't imagine how I could have seen a helicopter from any angle would have made it present such an odd appearance." She also had given a lot of consideration to the idea the object was some sort of man-made gadget, but she was equally well aware of the fact that her report seemed to fall squarely into the flying saucer category. Anything that can't be readily identifiable? Mistaken identity. Well, she continued to write almost at the time of her death at the age of 90 in 1983, and her contribution to British literature is more than well recognized. Now, that being said, we need to take a look at a wave of black helicopter encounters that occurred in 1975, which may well have originated at Area 51. Now, one of the many curious aspects of the UFO phenomenon that's relative to what you might call a flap, which is the term that's been given to numerous sightings. Over the years, UFOs intruded into our airspace to a significant degree on more than a few occasions. The summer of 1947, the invasion of Washington, D.C. in July 1952, the encounters that hit the U.S. in 1973, the Belgian Flying Triangle encounters of 89 and 90, the UFO Phantom helicopter wave of 1975. Now, it's disturbing because a great deal of concern was exhibited by the U.S. military, despite the fact that the famous Project Blue Book closed its doors in 1969, notably and thanks to the Freedom of Information Act. It's possible to track just how seriously these matters were taken. Now, even a cursory examination of the history of UFO phenomena demonstrates that sightings of these so-called black helicopters or phantom helicopters are abound, particularly in evidence during the cattle mutilation wave of the mid-70s. On that note, we've run out of time for tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and we're going to be talking more about phantom helicopters. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.